It's time for the Des Moines Register on Monday, March 11. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. I'm Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Nicole Tam. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinion, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and from donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. Excuse me, AccuWeather says that across the state today it should be mostly sunny, breezy, and warmer. Winds south-southwest 12 to 25 miles per hour. On Tuesday, warm with clouds and sun, pleasant in the north. And the forecast for the next few days in central Iowa looks like this. Today and tonight, a high of 72 and a low of 49. Mostly sunny, breezy, and warmer today. Winds south-southwest 12 to 25 miles per hour. Breezy this evening, otherwise partly cloudy and mild. On Tuesday, breezy in the morning and look for a high of 69 and a low of 44. On Wednesday, it should be partly sunny and pleasant with a high of 69 and a low of 49. On Thursday, look for a couple of showers. We'll have a high of 58 and a low of 36. Looking at precipitation in the 24 hours through 4 p.m. on Saturday, we've had a trace. The month to date is 24 hundredths of an inch, and the normal for this month to date would be 54 hundredths of an inch. Our year to date has been 2.57 inches, and a year to date normal would have been 3.02 inches. Last year at this time, we'd had 4.13 inches of precipitation. And we're still tracking snowfall, probably will through the end of this month. In the 24 hours through 4 p.m. Saturday, we had 0 inches of snowfall. Our month to date has been a trace, with the normal month to date 1.9 inches. Our season to date is 34.2 inches of snow. And normally by this date in the season, we would have had only 32.9 inches of snow. Sunrise today was at 7:32 a.m. Sunset tonight at 7:17 p.m. Hope you all remember to set your clocks yesterday so that now we're on daylight savings time. Moonrise today, 8:19 a.m. and moonset today at 9:18 p.m. Turning now to the front page of the Des Moines Register, a good portion of the front page is taken up by a very large picture that shows the University of Iowa's women's wrestling team celebrating after they captured the first place trophy Saturday at the National Collegiate Women's Wrestling Championship. This picture is taken with them on the floor and a lot of fans in the streets at the Alliant Energy Powerhouse in Cedar Rapids. The Hawkeyes crowned 6 individual champions and won a national team title in the program's first season. Kylie Welker, the first recruit to commit to Iowa in 2022, clinched the team championship with a victory in the 170-pound final on Saturday. The only other story on the front page is headlined, "Most Iowans in Favor of Non-Prescription Birth Control," and this is an Iowa poll register exclusive. And now with that story, here's Nicole.
Yeah, because of that sports story being the headline story, I'm going to wait until the sports folks get in the second hour. So, yes, that is a good preview of what's in the front page, but we do want to get to other headlines on your Monday morning, so we will start with that poll about non-prescription birth control. 70% of Republicans and 90% of Democrats express support. This is from Michaela Ram of the Des Moines Register. A strong majority of Iowans support Governor Kim Reynolds' proposal to allow pharmacies to sell birth control without a prescription. This is according to a new Des Moines Register MediaCom Iowa poll. Legislation being considered by state lawmakers would allow Iowans age 18 and older to purchase certain forms of birth control such as pills, birth control patches, and vaginal rings without first seeing a doctor. The bill does not include drugs intended to induce an abortion. Prescription-free birth control in Iowa has been a long-time legislative priority of Iowa's Republican governor, who first proposed this legislation in 2019. But the issue has divided Republicans at the Iowa legislature, and so far, a bill has yet to reach Reynolds' desk for her signature. The Iowa poll found that nearly 8 in 10 Iowans, that's 79%, support making birth control pills available without a prescription in the state. 19% of Iowans oppose it, and 3% aren't sure. The poll of 804 Iowa adults was conducted on February 25th to 28th by Seltzer & Company. It does have a margin of error of plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. Provisions of the bill the House state lawmakers are considering, House File 2584, would allow pharmacists to dispense an initial 3-month supply of birth control and a 12-month supply after that. It also requires pharmacists to screen patients and states that patients must see a physician within 27 months after a pharmacist dispense of that birth control. The bill also was recently amended by a House committee to require insurance companies to cover birth control dispensed without a prescription. Reynolds' bill passed a key legislative deadline this session that has not received a floor vote. The Iowa poll found that prescription-free birth control earns the support of majority of Iowans across the political spectrum. Results among independents closely mirror the state as a whole, with 80% in favor and 18% opposed. 70% of Republicans favor this policy, compared to 27% who oppose it. The overwhelmingly majority of Democrats, 90%, support this policy, with 9% opposed. Jessica Allen, a registered Democrat and poll respondent who agreed to a follow-up interview, supports the proposal. She takes birth control pills to help manage symptoms of endometriosis. It's a disorder that causes painful cramps each month. The 43-year-old stay-at-home mother from Des Moines believes that birth control pills should be more accessible because they are safe and effective. And she thinks the birth control available under the policy does not require strict oversight of a doctor. Allen said it doesn't seem like there's a justification to control birth control pills. It makes sense that the autonomy argument should win out because there aren't really that many dangers I'm aware of. The Iowa poll found some modest variation in support based on age. 83% of Iowans younger than 45 favor the proposal, compared to 15% of the people who oppose. Among those Iowans 45 years and older, 75% support it and 22% are opposed. The issue has received support from some Republican lawmakers in recent years as they have considered legislation, with supporters arguing that increased access to birth control would be an important tool in reducing abortion. Several faith-based anti-abortion groups oppose the idea, arguing it may still lead to unintended pregnancies. Poll respondent Jason Saltz, a 56-year-old cargo pilot, echoed those concerns, saying that he doesn't believe that echoed those concerns, saying he doesn't believe there's evidence to support the claim that allowing access to birth control without a prescription would reduce abortions. The registered Republican from Altoona said, without clear instructions and warnings from a doctor, more patients may not understand factors that could make birth control less effective. That could lead to more unintended pregnancies and abortions, he argued. He says they're going to take those pills thinking, hey, I'm good to go, and the first time they take antibiotics or something else that make it ineffective, because young people don't always read the instructions, we're going to find a lot more young Iowans with babies, he said. With abortion facing an uncertain legal future in Iowa, poll respondent Dave Tucker, a self-identified independent from Ames, said that women in Iowa should have another tool to help them navigate the current political landscape. The Iowa Supreme Court is expected to release its decision by the end of June on whether Iowa's abortion ban outlaws the procedure after about 6 weeks of pregnancy should go into effect. State lawmakers passed the ban after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the Roe v. Wade decision, which guaranteed a constitutional right to abortion across the country. Tucker, a 59-year-old partner at a venture capital firm, says, I believe that in this world today that a lot of women are encountering a lot of new restrictions that they have never had to deal with before. I fundamentally believe in letting them make the choices and decisions rather than having something legislated. To give you a little more context about this Iowa poll, again, this was conducted in late February by that company. It is a telephone interview with 804 Iowans ages 18 years and older. Interviewers with Quantel Research contacted households with randomly selected landline and cell phone numbers that's supplied by another company. Interviews were administered in English, and respondents were adjusted by age, sex, and congressional district to reflect the general population based on recent American Community Survey estimates. The questions, based on the sample of 804 Iowa adults, have a maximum margin of error plus or minus 3.5 percentage points. That means that if this survey were repeated using the same questions and the same methodology, 19 times out of 20, the findings would not really vary from the true population value by more or plus and minus 3.5 percentage points. Results based on smaller samples of respondents, like gender or age, of course, will have a larger margin of error. Republishing the copyright Iowa poll without credit and on digital platforms links to originating content to the Des Moines Registered and Mediacom is not allowed. And there is also one last thing here. It's a pie graph where it just say that more than 3 in 4 Iowans favor allowing pharmacists to sell birth control pills without a prescription to adults. It just shows in favor in a pie graph, 79% are in favor, 19% oppose. Twyla?
Nicole, since we had only that one story on the front page, let's go ahead and turn to the two Iowa program stories on the second page before we go to Metro in Iowa. So the first of those says initial plans are revealed for a possible aquatic center in Waukee. Waukee residents are getting a first look at ideas for what a possible outdoor public aquatic center could look like. A consultant presented two concepts to the public on Wednesday at City Hall so residents can weigh in on what they'd like to see should Waukee move forward with the project. Both designs were based on past public responses from a survey, focus groups, and a public meeting. Excuse me. Waukee City Council has hired the consultant to study the scope, cost, and level of public support for the project before moving forward with official plans. Water's Edge Aquatic Design presented the design plans as part of its study. Common features between the two designs include a lazy river that runs around a deep water diving pool, rentable seating areas for parties, a concession area, pools or splash areas of different depths, and water slides of different heights. The differences in design mostly come down to size and layout. Waukee City Council member Chris Crone said she wants to find a design that would set apart what could be the first public aquatic center in Waukee from others in West Des Moines, Clive, and other areas in the metro. What we have to do is to find something unique, Crone said. Meanwhile, Waukee also has identified a potential site for the aquatic center, the southeast corner of the intersection of 11th Street and University Avenue, which is west of Sugar Creek Golf Course and Waukee Public Works. The consultant is expected to release its findings in late summer. If the council approves moving forward, a referendum to pay for the aquatic center would be on the ballot in November. Waukee residents last voted on an aquatic center referendum in 2010. Just more than 50% of voters approved a proposed $7.9 million public pool facility that would have included a walking track and large open green space. That referendum needed 60% approval in order to pass. A public survey conducted last fall found 85% of the nearly 1,200 Waukee residents who responded were in support of developing an outdoor aquatic center. Another 500 people from across the metro participated in the survey, according to Water's Edge. The most desired features include a lazy river, water slides, and toddler-friendly pools. And other features. In terms of programming, people most sought recreational swimming and swim lessons. More information about the project and future public feedback opportunities is available at watersedge.mysocialpinpoint.com/Waukee Pool/study. Nicole?
That's a mouthful to read, but hey, it's a website. And we have a short story here before we head on to Metro and Iowa. It's about a Des Moines man being arrested for allegedly beating his dog in 2022. This is from Jose Mendiola of the Des Moines Register. A Des Moines man was arrested and charged on Friday in connection to a 2022 animal abuse investigation. The Des Moines Police Department was dispatched to the 5900th block of Southeast 19th Street regarding an alleged assault. This is according to a news release. There, officers found and identified the suspect as Jeremine Hargrove, 44 years old, of Des Moines. During the investigation, police found that Hargrove had an active arrest warrant for an animal abuse case in 2022. Police have been trying to track down Hargrove since then, after a video of Hargrove allegedly brutally beating his dog surfaced. This is according to court documents. Hargrove was arrested without incident. The caller making the initial assault complaint call declined to file a police report, according to a news release. Hargrove was being held at the Polk County Jail, where his case has been forwarded to the Polk County Attorney's Office for prosecution.
And that does wrap up the state and local news in the front page section. So let's move now to the Metro and Iowa section. The first article says, neighbors appeal a sinkhole decision. Des Moines wants a homeowner to pay for a sinkhole that formed in his street, but he and his neighbors believe the repairs should be the city's responsibility since the damage is on a public right-of-way. Don Bergmeyer has filed an appeal in Polk County District Court to Des Moines' claim that he is and his neighbor are responsible for causing the sinkhole in the Drake neighborhood, potentially related to an underground utility line. Bergmeyer argues the city is acting illegally and unconstitutionally by saying that the property owners are responsible for the cost of the fix, and says instead the city should pay to repair the damage because the hole is in the street. The city did not provide an estimate on the size of the sinkhole, but the metal plate covering it is roughly 12 feet long and 8 feet wide. Bergmeyer described it as big enough for a car tire to fall into. Sinkholes happen when the ground below the land surface cannot support itself. They can occur naturally or be caused by things like sewage issues, water main breaks, and in some cases, abandoned coal mines. According to the court filing, Bergmeyer reached out to Des Moines in June of 2023 to report the hole in the road on 21st Street near the corner of Drake Park Avenue. He estimates the hole is about 2 feet from the curb in front of his home. He and his neighbor John Walter, also a petitioner in the filing, heard back from the city 6 months later via a letter. The letter acknowledged the sinkhole exists and declared it a public nuisance. It also said that Bergmeyer and Walter were responsible for repairing it. Bergmeyer told the Des Moines Register the letter did not say how much they owed, but believes it could cost as much as $10,000 to repair the damage. Des Moines did not immediately have a comment on that issue. Bergmeyer argues that he and his neighbor should not be responsible for paying for repairs since it's the city's right-of-way, and instead the cost should be covered by property taxes, the court filing says. It's in the street. They should be fixing it themselves with our taxpayer money, federal money. They get money from all over, he told the Register last week. Bergmeyer said he requested an administrative hearing to contest the letter from the city, but a judge ruled against him and his neighbor. He also hired a plumber who said he has what he called a good clean sewer line from his house to the street, according to the court filing. Bergmeyer alleged the city's testimony during the administrative hearing was hearsay because the city employee who testified could not answer where the sinkhole was located or how the problem exists. In the meantime, the city put a metal plate over the hole to protect cars that pass over it. When city officials get reports of sinkholes, they will send a crew to look into the cause. If the sinkhole occurs near a sewer utility, crews will investigate sewer lines to determine if that's the cause. This type of occurrence is referred to as a cavity, where there's an absence of soil under the road, according to public works officials. If the city suspects a resident sewer is causing the cavity, the city might ask the person's permission to use cameras or a dye to test, a dye test to confirm. A dye test is a plumbing procedure designed to determine how sewer lines are connected and where water is running to and from. A homeowner is responsible for the sewer and the water line connections from their home to the mains in the street. If the issue is pinpointed to the homeowner's line, the city sends a letter to the resident noting the problem. It typically gives the resident three options: hire a plumber to fix the issues, ask the city to fix the issue and then pay the bill, or to ask the city for an administrative hearing to contest the issue. If the judge rules in favor of the city, the resident can also file with the Court of Appeals. Alternatively, if the issue is found on a public line, it is the city's responsibility to pay for repairs. Though not common in Des Moines, the city has seen its share of sinkholes, sometimes due to abandoned coal mines. In 2016, an abandoned underground coal mine likely contributed to a 30-foot-wide and 25-foot-deep sinkhole that opened up in the front yard of a Southside Des Moines home. Historical mining maps show the Southside Des Moines Coal Company operated a 203-acre mine beneath where the Southside neighborhood now sits. It was one of more than 200 mines that operated in the Des Moines area during the late 19th century and early 20th century. If you're in the Des Moines area, there's a good chance there's a coal mine beneath you, Calvin Walter, a geographic information systems analyst with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, told the Register at the time. The Iowa Geological Survey estimates that as many as 6,000 underground coal mines are scattered across 38 counties and could potentially affect 80,000 acres of Iowa land. Many of these mines are located in central Iowa.
All right, and the next Metro in Iowa story is grand plans in store for a downtown property, and guess where it is? On Grand Avenue. There's a large image that accompanies this story. It's an image of demolition of this construction site. It's the site of the Coach Office Group's former downtown location at 325 Grand Avenue, shown last week. So, as you guessed, there is a demolition underway for this building from Addison Lathers of the Des Moines Register. Coach Office Group's longtime downtown location at 325 Grand Avenue will soon be no more, but the company's owner says that something much bigger could be in the works for it and the surrounding properties. Demolition is now underway on the 24,538 square foot two-story structure that's built in 1900s. According to a permit issued to the DiCarlo Demolition Company, sidewalks and the bike path in front of the building will be reopening after Friday. The company, previously known as Coach Brothers, sold the building to the Knapp Properties for $1.8 million in March of 2023. Now, included in the purchase was an adjoining 8,840-square-foot parking lot. So what's next for the property? Coach Office Group, a printing and office supply company, initially planned to lease the property from Knapp after the sale. Knapp CEO Chris Costa told the Business Record in April that there were no immediate plans to raise the building. Now, however, Coach President Richard Dutch Coach says that there are bigger plans in store for 325 Grand Avenue and that it involves a partnership with philanthropist and developers Bill Knapp, founder and chair emeritus of Knapp Properties and Jim County. Coach says they have grand plans for a project of civic interest in that space, clarifying that it will still be a commercial development. We all live and work and love downtown Des Moines. The corner of 4th and Grand will be an important part of that going forward. Coach says that he was not at liberty to provide further details. Knapp Properties also owns adjacent tracts at 320 Watson Powell Jr. Way and 528 3rd Street. The 1.6-acre L-shaped set of parcels take up nearly three-quarters of a city block, and the building at 320 Watson Powell and of an office that once belonged to Steinman Family Physicians also is being raised. The city confirmed that it issued permits for that work, but the Office of Economic Development wasn't aware of a project at that location. In addition, Knapp owns other nearby properties just south of the Iowa Event Center's Hy-Vee Hall. It's an area currently occupied primarily by parking lots. County says that he's playing a small role in a bigger plan and referred questions to Costa, who said that he would not immediately comment. So, what's the history behind this building? Coach Office Group has occupied that building for nearly a century. Before that, he said, it served as a car dealership and after World War I, a YMCA. Coach inherited the business from his father, Richard Coach Sr., who had served as president after his father, William Coach, who died in 1964. According to the Des Moines Register's archives, the Coach family sold Iowa's first electric typewriter in 1930 and first dry photocopier in 1955. Coach says it's bittersweet. We've been here for nearly 100 years. The company's Des Moines headquarters is now an industrial area at 1803 Guthrie Avenue.
Smash Park announces a new location. West Des Moines-based Smash Park plans to open its first Eastern Time Zone location in a Columbus, Ohio suburb. Construction of the 50,000-square-foot venue at the Westar Place development in Westerville will start this summer, according to a Smash Park news release, and it will open roughly a year later with about 100 employees. Smash Park. Founded in 2018, Smash Park is an all-in-one active entertainment destination. The Columbus area venue will include 30,000 square feet of space for pickleball courts, axe throwing, duck spin bowling, and private karaoke suites, and another 15,000 square feet of outdoor space for additional pickleball courts and activities like shuffleboard and bocce ball. Smash Park offerings also will include arcade games, a restaurant, a rooftop bar, more than 100 TVs, and an area for dogs. Like the West Des Moines location, it will have an adults-only bar known as the Paddle Club, with darts, board games, and other recreational activities. Smash Parks also schedule weekly activities like trivia tournaments and a bingo brunch and rent space for private events. Since 2021, the company has been adding locations. Today, there are Smash Parks in Minneapolis, Roseville, Minnesota, a Minneapolis suburb, and the Omaha suburb La Vista, Nebraska. A location in Pella closed in January after less than 2 years in business. Last year, Sacramento, California, private equity firm DCA Partners announced an investment in Smash Park to help fuel its growth, focusing primarily on larger Midwestern cities. More locations are in the works, according to the release. The Columbus Metro is a diverse and active community, perfectly suited for the booming sport of pickleball and our other social offerings, Smash Park CEO Monty Lockyer said in the news release. We can't wait to bring our unique mix of food, drinks, entertainment, and recreation to Westerville and the surrounding area.
Twyla and I are going to have a date at Smash Park, so you can just keep repeating where we go for that fun day. But that was a cool story. Looking forward to that. Next, in the headline in Metro and Iowa, we're going to turn things over to Osceola, where no lasting relief yet for Iowa City's water supply issues. This is from Kevin Baskins of the Des Moines Register. Despite its dwindling reservoir amid Iowa's continued drought, Osceola will open its aquatic center and water its municipal golf course greens this summer, although it is taking some creativity to accomplish these goals. Another Iowa public water supply experiencing drought-related supply issues, the Regional Water Rural Water Association in Avoca, or I think it is Avoca, I think that's how you pronounce that city. It has seen an improvement in that water availability in its wells, but has also experienced increased demand, placing it in the yellow alert status and asking its customers to conserve. This move comes as the Iowa Department of Natural Resources notes that there has been little progress since the end of January in alleviating Iowa's ongoing drought, now approaching 4 years in duration. Tim Hall, the DNR's Hydrology Resource Coordinator, said in a March 7th update, a very dry February has wiped out much of the benefit received from the wet January. The encouraging trend that started in the winter has not continued. March through June are critical months for water resources in Iowa, and normal to above normal rainfall is critical this year especially. But despite the concern, the DNR has approved Osceola's request to move about 4 million gallons from two city water bodies, Grave Lake and Coupond, to Westlake, the reservoir that supplies the city's water. Moving the water is still contingent on testing to make sure there are no toxins present in that water to be transferred, according to Osceola Mayor Thomas Keatley. New drone video from the city shows Westlake's continued decline, and the decision to open the Fern Underwood Family Aquatic Center has been controversial. The Osceola City Council voted 3-1 in February to not open the pool this summer, and then responded with a 5-0 override when Kedley vetoed that decision. Ultimately, the decision to proceed with opening the pool came after the Osceola Water Board of Trustees granted authority to the council to open up the park if it deemed it would be critical to the general welfare of the community. Kedley says that he agreed to the council's initial vote but then vetoed the measure because the pool was scheduled for renovations to start on March 1st and that the project would require water for a sealing process. He said the veto was intended to provide more time for the pool work to start. Being able to move 4 million gallons from the two smaller lakes to West Lake will offset the water usage needed for the aquatic center and the golf course. Also being investigated is the feasibility of using water from a 9-acre, 50-foot-deep quarry near town. Kedley says, as it is the possibility of using gray water, the treated effluent from the city's wastewater plant. The DNR is considering an earlier request by the city to use the treated water to help bolster West Lake. The lake currently is about 7 feet below its normal level. The water board is, among other measures, prohibiting outdoor water use except for fire and health hazards, and also restricting commercial use that's not essential in providing products and services. Both Kedley and Water Superintendent Brandon Patterson says the Osceola community has complied with requests to reduce water usage. Kedley says the local hospital and the city's Hormel meatpacking plant have made big cuts in usage, and our citizens have gone above and beyond to conserve water. The next emergency stage could kick in if the Westlake water levels drops another 2 feet, at which time the mayor would be asked to issue an emergency proclamation and bottled water would start to be distributed. Another 3 feet of decline would trigger a request by Clark County Emergency Management for aid from the state. Patterson says the biggest concern is the onset of summer. While the normal draw for water supply is 1 million to 1.1 million gallons a day, with a peak day of 2 million gallons last summer, the water threat would come if, as the lake water evaporates, rain is insufficient to replenish it. The 3-month forecast for March through May by the National Weather Service calls for a 40% to 50% chance of above normal precipitation in the southern half of Iowa, but also a 30 to 40% chance of above average temperatures. West Lake currently has a safe withdrawal capacity of 800,000 gallons of water a day, with a projected daily demand of 2.8 million gallons a day in 20 years. Both Kedley and Patterson says the long-term solution for Osceola is construction of a new 800-acre reservoir that had been tied up in red tape for decades, but it's slowly moving forward once again. Like Osceola, the Regional Water Rural Water Association in Avoca has had somewhat of a roller coaster this winter. The association built a rifle dam on the branch of the, Nishnabotna River? I think that's how you pronounce that. But that river to raise the water level to recharge the shallow aquifers that feed the district's wells. An extreme cold snap in January froze the ponds, forcing some livestock producers to pump water from the district. In addition, pent-up demand for washing farms equipment quickly offset the increase in available water. This is according to Tom Coleman, the general manager of the district. After being able to briefly lift conservation efforts in December, the district had to restore its yellow level advisory once again in January, according to Coleman. He says that we sold more water in January than any other month in our 52-year history, and with February unseasonably warm, it didn't get much better. Help is now on the way in the form of an 18-mile line from Council Bluffs capable of providing 400,000 gallons of treated water a day. The Regional Water Rural Water Association serves over 2,600 customers in Shelby, Audubon, Cass, Harrison, and northern Pottawatomie counties. Coleman says the pipeline should be bid in the next 6 to 8 weeks, with construction starting soon after. As in Osceola, Coleman says the customers in his district have provided tremendous support in cutting usage, but he says the real solution is rain to get water back down into the water table. In the meantime, the best we can do is plan for the worst and hope for the best.
And that wraps up the Metro and Iowa section, so we'll head back to the front page section and pick up some national and then international news. Our first story says family-based addiction recovery is knocking down barriers. This is a special from the Columbus Dispatch, which is part of the USA Today network and Dateline Columbus, Ohio. When Christina Perry runs out to her car to get something, she no longer sees her 10-year-old daughter Karen watching from the window, making sure she comes back. "It's a new level of trust in their relationship," said Perry, who's 30 years old, as a former addict who was not always able to be there for Karen. Perry has now been sober for more than 3 years, and Karen has lived with her for most of that time, thanks in large part to Amethyst, a recovery program. The Amethyst program is one of approximately 360 family-based residential treatment programs across the country that allow women to go through residential addiction recovery with their children or help them get custody of their children back as they work through recovery. But with an estimated 8.7 million children in the U.S. living with at least one parent with a substance use disorder, and only an estimated 5% of people with addiction ever getting treatment, experts say there are far too few programs like Amethyst. The need is one of the reasons that Amethyst, a nearly 40-year-old program, is expanding in Columbus, Ohio later this year. Another organization, Volunteers of America, Ohio and Indiana, is also working to open Fresh Start Family-Focused Recovery Program in downtown Columbus this spring. Similar to Amethyst, this program will focus on keeping families together through the Fresh Start Program, though the Fresh Start Program is focused on helping pregnant mothers in hopes of increasing healthy births, said Jennifer Martinez, Vice President of Behavioral Health Operations in Ohio. More than 3,200 Ohio children were removed from their homes in 2023 due to a parent's substance abuse. I'm sorry, that the word they use here is substance use. I think that people are trying to avoid using the term abuse. So let me read that correctly. More than 3,200 Ohio children were removed from their homes in 2023 due to a parent's substance use, according to the Ohio Department of Job and Family Services. Meanwhile, the hundreds of family-based residential recovery programs for parents with children in the nation are not covering as much ground as people may think, said Margaret Ratcliffe, an executive vice president with Volunteers of America's national office. Excuse me. Programs exist in 48 states, Washington, D.C., and Puerto Rico. But some states have many programs while others have few, creating huge gaps, said Ratcliffe, who worked on the 2019 study that examined the number of programs in the nation. Part of the reason for those gaps is the struggle for funding. Amethyst and Fresh Start are both funded through multiple sources, including state and federal grants, private donations, and Medicaid. There are also efforts to get insurance companies to help fund programs like these, she said. There are a lot of untreated people, Ratcliffe said. Women and children have a harder time getting into treatment if they cannot bring their women with children have a harder time getting into treatment if they can't bring their children. What's very important, of course, is keeping the family together. There's nothing that harms the child more than being separated, losing that bond, Ratcliffe said. Both Amethyst and Volunteers of America, both of which do or will accept mothers with multiple children up to age 18, understand the existing need for family-based recovery programs in Columbus, as does Franklin County Children's Services. In 2023, the Franklin County Agency investigated 842 cases of infants who were exposed to substances prenatally or who were affected by their parents' substance, spokesman Scott Varner said. This type of program is definitely much needed in our community as a way to help keep children with parents who need an inpatient level of substance abuse treatment, Varner said, of Family of America's Fresh Start Family-Focused Recovery Program. Amethyst has a new, larger campus under development in Columbus. Slated to be completed later this year, it will be able to house 52 women and their children compared to the 25 units in its existing building that will be replaced by the new campus. Volunteers of America has a five-story building in downtown Columbus that is expected to open in July for its Fresh Start program and will be able to house approximately 34 women and their children. According to Martinez, the residential treatment center will feature medical care, addiction therapy, behavioral health services, on-site daycare, and other support for families. The goal with the new VOA program, which will be open to all women, is to keep families together, Martinez said. Fresh Start hopes to serve 120 women per year, with women staying there for 90 to 120 days before they are assisted in finding housing and jobs. We want to prevent county children's services from having to get involved, she said. What we really want to do is intervene while mom is still pregnant. Then they can help mothers access prenatal care and stop using drugs. There's a lot of guilt and shame that goes with this, Martinez said, of women who have substance use disorder and become pregnant. Even women who want to stop using substances are afraid to reach out for help because they're afraid they're going to lose their kids. That is a very reasonable fear to have, said Martinez. More than 200 children were removed from their Franklin County homes last year, due at least in part to apparent substance abuse, Varner said. Despite research evidence of trauma that is often caused by separating children from their parents, at the same time, 479 families, or about 32%, who engaged in ongoing care with the agency last year, had cases involving concerns about at least one parent's drug or alcohol abuse. I can count on both hands the number of agencies that treat women, said Linda James, Amethyst's chief operating officer. I think we're unique, but we cannot serve 100% of those in need, she said. Prevention worked well for Linda Armstrong, who entered a similar VOA program in Indiana right after giving birth to her daughter Emerson, who is now 2. Armstrong, who is age 37, was at risk of losing custody of her unborn child when she learned of a VOA Fresh Start program near her home in Lebanon, Indiana. She knew if she lost her daughter, she would be likely to go back to using methamphetamines. Then Fresh Start accepted her and taught Armstrong how to build the structure and routine she needed to get and stay sober and to raise her daughter. The Fresh Start program changed my life, Armstrong said. I know reunification is big when it comes to kids getting reunited with their family, but if they can keep them together as they go through, it makes all the difference in the world, she said. Even if moms need residential treatment for addiction, they may not seek care because they fear leaving or losing custody of their children, Martinez said. There are also fewer addiction treatment programs for women than men, and even fewer for women with children, she said. But bringing children into the program with the mothers is exactly how the trajectory of the opioid epidemic can be changed, Martinez said. Get kids on that path so they don't repeat what's happening with their parents, she said. Perry was part of a cycle of addiction. Her mother used drugs during her entire childhood, eventually fatally overdosing in 2012. And each of her 3 siblings also struggled with addiction. Addiction runs in my family, Perry said. I've seen it my whole life, and I started using at 13, she said. Amethyst allows women like Perry to stay up to 2 years if necessary, Jane said. They help women get their children back or set up visitation with them and work their case plans with Children's Services, she said. It's not only helping moms, it's breaking the cycle, Jane said. As part of the program, Perry learned that while she cannot change her past, she can move forward and parent in a healthy way. I'm finally at the place in my life where I know that I can't change my past. I can't change what I exposed my daughter to or anything she's been through, Perry said. Me staying sober, me being her mom now, that's the only thing I have control over. I don't have to be a perfect mom as long as I'm doing my best, she said.
All right, and this next article I'm reading is actually from the online edition of the Register. I'm going to go over some health news here. The headline, Iowa could become the next Alabama over personhood legislation. This is from Michaela Ram of the Des Moines Register. It's an online article. So Karen Matthews says that she owes her whole being to in vitro fertilization. 17 years ago, the 41-year-old Polk City resident and her husband started IVF to start a family. An eating disorder in college meant that Matthews had a suppressed ovulation cycle, prompting the couple to seek out fertility treatment at Mid-Iowa Fertility in Des Moines. After 2 rounds of treatment, Matthews and her husband welcomed 3 children, a daughter in 2009 and twin sons in 2012. She says, I owe my whole being to Dr. Brian Cooper and Mid-Iowa Fertility. If they weren't there, there was no way that I would have had the family that I have. Matthews, who is now a nurse at Mid-Iowa Fertility, told the Des Moines Register. She says, I'm not really sure of how many other jobs where you can help create life and help people basically reach their dreams of being parents. I don't know of anything else out there that could really satisfy me as much as finding the first heartbeat for somebody's first child after they've been struggling for 5 to 10 years. But recent court rulings and legislation are raising fears that IVF treatments may be in jeopardy. Shockwaves swept through the industry and throughout the rest of the country recently after the Alabama State Supreme Court ruled that embryos created through IVF should be legally considered children. Hospitals and fertility clinics paused treatments in the days that followed. Last week, Alabama state lawmakers gave final approval to legislation to protect IVF providers and patients from criminal and civil liability. The bill has yet to be signed into law by Alabama's governor. The Alabama ruling has no direct impact in Iowa, but it has opened the door to questions about the possible impacts to IVF care here in the state from providers like Matthews and Cooper and the physician at Mid-Iowa Fertility. In particular, providers and advocates worry about the potential legal ramifications of existing Iowa law defining, quote, unborn child, and from new legislation state lawmakers are now considering that furthers the effort to define fertilized embryos as personhood. Cooper says we're tampering in ground that it's difficult for science to define, which makes it exceedingly more difficult for politicians to define. Iowa Code Chapters 146A and 146B define, quote, unborn child as an individual organism of the species Homo sapiens from fertilization until live birth. That language was established in Iowa as part of the law that passed in 2017, establishing Iowa's current 20-week abortion ban. Under that provision, the language applies only to doctors performing abortions in the state. While this existing law doesn't directly pertain to regulation of fertility care, its language has the potential to cause ramifications in Iowa similar to those that played out in Alabama. This is according to legal and medical experts interviewed by the Register. Alan Ostergreen, president of the Kirkwood Institute and a prominent conservative attorney, says plaintiffs in a lawsuit could use that language to argue any loss of embryos is not destruction of property, but instead a wrongful death. As in Alabama, that distinction would be up to Iowa's courts to decide. So far, no lawsuit has been set that kind of precedent, according to Ostergreen. He says whether their damages would be for the destruction of their property or would have been a wrongful death claim, those plaintiffs would have to persuade the Iowa Supreme Court that the law should recognize the embryo as a child and not just an embryo. There is not a code section right now that would directly answer that question. Legislation Iowa lawmakers are considering this session, House File 2575, uses the same language as existing law. The bill, which was approved by the Iowa House on Thursday, would create stricter policies for terminating a person's pregnancy without their consent. The bill is awaiting a Senate vote. There is another bill, House File 2518, that uses the same, quote, unborn person definition to allow Iowans to bring wrongful death lawsuits over, quote, wrongful death of an unborn child, which would include a fertilized embryo. Republican lawmakers are trying to taper down fears that the same thing that happened in Alabama awaits Iowa. Melissa Seitz, the spokesperson for Iowa House Speaker Pat Grassley, said in a statement, "These bills were not crafted with the intention of having any effect on IVF, and they don't make any changes to IVF in Iowa. The Alabama Supreme Court has no effect on Iowa law, and as always, the speaker will continue to seek feedback from Iowans on any legislative changes that they would like to be made on this topic in the future." To Cooper, the physician at Mid-Iowa Fertility, the personhood statute does not mean IVF treatments could not take place in Iowa. However, he says it would pose huge ramifications for key pieces of that care, including genetic testing and disposing of leftover embryos. He says, "I think we could still be able to do some treatment, but it can significantly limit what we're able to do and take some of our most useful tools away." If fertilized embryos are defined as persons, Cooper said, it's unclear whether providers would be allowed to discard or donate frozen embryos that patients don't want to use. To fertility care providers, perhaps the most concerning aspect are the implications for genetic testing, which clinics rely on to detect abnormalities or otherwise ensure that patients are receiving healthy embryos that are more likely to result in a healthy birth. In some cases, patients who aren't struggling to get pregnant seek out IVF treatment to ensure that implanted embryos don't inherit severe genetic conditions such as Huntington's disease. Through this method, Cooper says the IVF providers have the opportunity to, quote, virtually eliminate deadly conditions in children. Cooper says, who doesn't see the positivity in that? But if you define that personhood begins at conception and I have an embryo affected, you're telling me I've got to put that back? That's where the quagmire comes in. Iowa's effort aligns with a longtime campaign nationwide by anti-abortion advocates for governments to define fetal personhood, therefore recognizing a fetus as a person and also grant them rights and protections guaranteed to people. Republican lawmakers dismissed concerns that the bill approved by the Iowa House would have ramifications similar to those playing out in Alabama, stating that during last week's debate that the existing Iowa law has not had any effect. Still, Democrats and other advocates have raised alarms about this effort, particularly since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, which opened the door for states, including Iowa, to establish strict abortion laws. Maisie Stilwell, the Director of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood Advocates for Iowa, said the proposed legislation is a blatant attempt to further conservatives' advocates' anti-abortion agenda in the state. She argued the additional personhood language in Iowa law has the potential to create chaos within the legal system. Stilwell says the GOP has power to take away people's control over their bodies and their lives, and unfortunately, access to IVF is no different. Ostergreen argued the overturning of Roe v. Wade opened the door for legislative scrutiny for certain medical practices, including IVF and surrogacy. Cooper pushed back on that argument, saying that IVF treatment and other fertility care is one of the most regulated fields in medicine. He also said the industry has guidelines from multiple medical regulatory bodies to ensure that providers are delivering the most ethical care possible. Cooper says they really need to understand what's already happening before you come in from the outside and try to impose something else, especially when you're not intimately familiar with what happens in your world. You just end up restricting care and taking useful science away from patients that can really benefit from it. Matthews disagrees with the push to define fertilized embryos as people, saying that she views those embryos more as a potential for life without numerous medical interventions and support. Many of those don't grow beyond a bundle of cells. Even then, she says, there isn't a guarantee a healthy birth will result. She said, it scares me. It's not so black and white. There's a lot of gray area in the middle. It impacts a lot of people, and they don't understand that. So unless you work in it every day, you would never understand it.
Okay. Biden says Netanyahu is hurting Israel. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Sunday that Israelis overwhelmingly support his policies and rejected President Joe Biden's assertion that the war in Gaza was hurting Israel. If he meant by that that I'm pursuing private policies against the majority, the wish of the majority of Israelis, and that this is hurting the interests of Israel, then he's wrong on both counts, Netanyahu said in a social media post Sunday. The vast majority are united as never before, he said. The prime minister said Israelis believe that if Israel does not fight, it will see a repetition of the October 7 attack that killed 1,200 people in Israel and saw the seizure of over 240 hostages. That, he said, would be bad for Israel, bad for the Palestinians, and bad for the future of peace in the Middle East. More than 31,000 Palestinians have died, 70% of them women and children, according to the Gaza Health Ministry. Israel says it has killed 13,000 Hamas militants and blames civilian deaths on militants using them as human shields. Biden, in an interview with MSNBC, had urged Netanyahu to curb the death toll of civilians in Gaza, but asserted that the U.S. has no plans to cut off the supply of weapons to the military in Israel. Biden asked what tough love he would give Netanyahu, responded that Netanyahu had a right to defend his country, but must, quoting here from Biden, pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. In my view, he said, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel. Biden said Netanyahu's policies are contrary to what Israel stands for, and I think it's a big mistake, so I want to see a neat ceasefire. That's the end of the quote from Mr. Biden. The crescent moon appeared Sunday night in Saudi Arabia, home to the holiest sites of Islam, making the start of the month of Ramadan and an end to hopes that ceasefire deal would be reached before the Islamic holy season. That would be marking the start of Ramadan, the month of Ramadan. Efforts by the U.S., Egypt, and Qatar to broker a ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas remain stalled over two crucial demands, Hamas said in a statement Sunday. Hamas wants a pathway to a permanent end to the war and the relocation of all Israeli troops out of Gaza. Around three-quarters of Jewish respondents are in favor of expanding military operations into Rafah, according to a new poll by the Israeli Democracy Institute. The U.S. and other nations have urged Israel not to invade the southern Gaza city, where more than 1 million residents are seeking shelter from the war. The first 6 days of March saw an increase in the number of humanitarian trucks entering Gaza, with an average of 155 trucks per day crossing, the UN Relief Workers Agency said. The flow remains well below the 500 per day target set by the United Nations Refugee Agency, which said trucks continue to struggle to enter Gaza amid what it called inconsistent opening of border crossings. The U.S. and Jordan have begun aid airdrops, and efforts are underway to move aid to Gaza from ships. There's still an awful lot of work that's being done on this to flesh it out, John Kirby, the White House spokesman for national security issues, said last week. But he added that the best and most efficient way to get aid into people in a confined space like that in a very urban environment is on the ground. That's a quote from Mr. Kirby. Meanwhile, the refugee agency said some employees released into Gaza from Israeli detention claim Israeli authorities pressured them into falsely accusing some staffers of taking part in the October 7 attacks, Reuters reported. Claims of beatings, sexual violence, waterboarding, and threats of harm to family members are included in the UN Refugee Agency report reviewed by Reuters and dated February 2024. UN Communications Director Juliette Tuma said the agency planned to provide information in the 11-page unpublished report to agencies documenting potential human rights abuses. An Israeli military spokesperson told Reuters the military follows international law, denies any claims of sexual abuse, and said freed detainees can be forced by Hamas to denounce Israel. Reports that some United Nations refugee workers took part in the October 7 attack on Israel led to the U.S. and more than a dozen other nations cutting off funding to the agency, which provides humanitarian aid to Palestinians. An emergency UN Security Council session on Monday will review the report on Hamas sexual violence prepared by Special Envoy Primula Patton that found reasonable grounds to believe Hamas committed rape, sexualized torture, and other cruel treatment of women, and that the violence may be continuing with some hostages. Some family members of Israeli hostages are expected to attend the session. Across the various locations of the 7 October attacks, the mission team found that several fully naked partially naked bodies from the waist down were recovered, mostly women, with hands tied and shot multiple times, often in the head, the report said. And now before we go to the birthdays, I'm going to share the highlight from USA Today's 50 States section. This is from Wisconsin. Franklin, Wisconsin. About a dozen fifth grade students crowded around Michael DeMain and a 175-year-old maple tree in the forest preserve surrounding the Weir National Center in Franklin, eager to collect sap on a warm late February afternoon. The children use their math skills to add up the number of cups of the sweet liquid they collect. Maple tapping season, a tradition started by indigenous peoples, is upon us, but it can be difficult for tribal families in the Milwaukee area to practice this part of their heritage. The students who are learning about maple tapping have tribal heritage and attend the Indian Community School. And that's accompanied with a lovely picture of three young women tapping a maple tree.